Hey everyone, welcome or welcome back to Real Recovery. If you're new here, this is a podcast where I talk about anorexia recovery, but today's episode is kind of special. It's a bit different. Basically, today's episode, I speak to a qualified therapist. So her name is Scarlett. She's from London. She emailed me recently and we both decided it'd be a great idea for her to come onto the podcast and share her experience. She has personal experience with anorexia and bulimia and binge eating disorder. She had an eating disorder for 25 years and now she's been recovered for the last 10 years. She says she's now fully recovered, and I think this whole conversation is going to be very inspiring and motivational for you guys listening. So in this conversation, we talk mainly about behaviors associated with bulimia or binge purge subtype anorexia. And we also talk about the male experience of eating disorders and how men are in some way struggle more with social stigma and stuff to do with their eating disorder. And I think that part of the conversation was really interesting. So we talk about all sorts of things. Again, I think it's just very inspiring to hear from somebody who has struggled for so long in so many different ways and who has managed to get to the place that she is now, where she's helping people for a living. She has that professional background, which I think is always valuable. And I'm just really excited for you guys to hear about what she has to say. So yeah, I hope you enjoy the episode. And a big thank you to Scarlett for coming on the podcast today. Of course, I just want to mention to anybody who is sensitive to topics of eating disorders, specifically purging behaviors, those topics will be covered in today's episode. So here is your warning in advance. But yeah, let's get into it and let's welcome Scarlett. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Okay, do you want to just introduce yourself then to everyone listening?
Yeah, definitely. It's really great to be here. My name's Scarlett O'Connor. I am a qualified therapist. I'm from London in the UK. And I focus solely now, I have worked one-to-one with many clients over the years in different modalities, but I focus solely now on eating disorders and in particular bulimia and binge purge anorexia. Those are my two main areas of expertise now.
Great. Okay. So obviously you emailed me about coming on to the podcast. I just want to know, obviously from my point of view, I was very keen on having you on, but what made you want to come and share your story to people?
I mean, I'm all about raising awareness around eating disorders. It's like we said in the emails, there is a lot of talk in the media now about eating disorders, but it's normally focused around not eating or anorexia. And I feel that there is a lot of shame attached to bulimia and the binge purge type eating disorders that people don't want to discuss so much, because it's not a nice thing to suffer from, it's not a nice thing to talk about, and I feel like that shame is a massive barrier to people accessing treatment, and it's also very isolating. So I'm all about having very raw, very open discussions around those elements of eating disorders.
Well, that's great. I think that's really key point, and I think it's even on social media and recovery communities, there's often, I don't know, I feel like it's very much focused on anorexia, and obviously that even anorexia you can still have binge purge behaviors within that, which I feel like it's just not really spoken about, even though it should be, because many people suffer with it in the same sort of way as restrictive symptoms as well. But
it's true. Binge and purge, I'm not a fan of diagnostic criteria as such, but I was officially what you would have termed a binge purge anorexic, which is very common. People, get put into diagnostic boxes. But it's like you say, those binge purge elements are not discussed because they're embarrassing, and they're not people, even when people have recovered, I don't feel like they're truly comfortable addressing that addictive side of the cyclic nature of eating disorders.
Yeah, I completely agree. I can really see that. So yeah, that kind of leads me to my first question for you, which is basically, how were you able to open up to people and start getting help and start getting treatment? And I do wonder if, again, shame and stigma around these behaviours, did that ever make it harder?
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. When I first, I had eating disorders for 25 years, and when I fought my battle with my binge and purging, my bulimia, if you like, it's easier just to term it as bulimia. That was from the age of 19 to 38, and I'm nearly 48 now. So obviously, it's kind of a bit of a different era, and it wasn't spoken about as much. Even less so than it is now. And when I did go for any sort of treatment or therapies, which I didn't really want for the first 10 years or so, but when I was finally ready mentally and physically to try and get help, it was really, really difficult to go and actually be asked, how much do you eat? How do you purge? What do you do? And that would instantly recoil me from having treatment, and most definitely put me off. Which is why I don't shame my clients now in the way that I use my approach. But personally, I didn't open up as such until I was able to recover myself. And to do that, I had to reach a crisis point, unfortunately.
It is so true for so many people. I feel like they're like having to reach a crisis point before they can open up about stuff. I wonder what your opinions are on like the professionals, people, at least from my experience and from the people I've spoken to who are younger. When we have like spoken to therapists and psychologists and stuff, they perhaps don't know, like they wouldn't necessarily know that binging and purging could be experienced within anorexia. They would just see someone based off their weight, but then not really inquire about those behaviors, which I felt like definitely happened to me and might have overlooked certain parts. And I do wonder, like, what's your experience with that, and what's your opinion?
Well, that's shocking to hear for a start that people aren't actually asked, about those kind of behaviors. When I say not shaming, so for example, within my normal therapy practice, if somebody came to me and said I was abused as a child, that would be enough for me. We wouldn't then need to spend, unless somebody wanted to, but we wouldn't then need to spend 6 months discussing every single aspect of that in order to be able to progress and go forward. We would ascertain that there was a trauma. And that had an effect on the mind and body, and we'd go forward from there. And it's kind of the same when I say not shaming, that doesn't mean that I wouldn't establish with a client that, yes, there is binging and purging behavior here, but that's as far as it needs to go. Like the shaming element to me is going into numbers, because the diagnostic criteria will say you have to binge and purge a certain amount of times per week in order to be diagnosed, etc., etc. So when I say not shaming, not asking people to clarify the amounts of food they eat or what they eat, et cetera, is what I mean. I would just need to have a basic understanding that yes, those behaviors are present, and yes, we do need to address them in therapy. But to hear from someone younger that they are actually not even asked that when accessing help is absolutely horrifying to me. It's kind of like outweighs the question. I was sort of talking about the fact that people go too far into it and indeed shame people, because I know that diagnostically, if you don't binge a certain amount of times or purge a certain amount of times, you won't fit the criteria to get treated as a bulimic, say. So I'm actually taken aback, that anybody isn't actually asked. I've not heard that before.
I can vouch for that personally, and for people I've spoken to, I feel like it's probably not the fault of anyone asking the questions. It's just that they don't have time, and it's just like so overwhelms the system. So I'm guessing people don't really get enough attention and focus.
Or potentially, as we're talking about here, the shame of being able to actually say to a professional, what might happen there is that a professional might make an assumption based on somebody's appearance, which I absolutely cannot stand because eating disorders do not have a shape and a size. But it's exactly as we're saying in that incidence, the shame element that would mean that the client had to, come forward and say, well, yeah, actually, I binge and purge, which is something which isn't spoken about. And that's the whole point of how we started this conversation, isn't it? There is a massive stigma attached to it, a massive amount of shame, and people don't want to talk about it. Going to a GP or somebody and saying, well, I've got an eating disorder, and then saying, I binge and purge, it is very, very difficult. So
Yeah.
we're talking about two different extremes. Some of them go too far in order for you to fit into the diagnostic criteria, making people recount every single thing that they eat and what every single behavior that they have. And then, as you've just highlighted, potentially they might not even talk about it at all. And because people are so embarrassed, I mean, it isn't a nice thing to admit to, is it? It's not, you know, it's not an attractive, or it's quite repulsive to other people. It's two extensions there, isn't it? Two extremes of the same cause you've got going on there.
Completely. And I think it is so important to have, like, if you are, you know, seeing a therapist or a doctor or whatever, it's like not going to either extreme. They just sort of sit in the middle and they just like accept what you're saying, and then they sort of go from there rather than reacting, I suppose. Something you said about how if someone says they've got trauma, then you just sort of accept it and then like move on.
Yeah. Or move into recovery. You kind of move that it's had an effect on the mind and the body, and then you look at what that is and how it manifests.
So with that, do you have practical techniques and almost coping skills would you recommend to people struggling with like binge purge, anorexia or bulimia or anything kind of to do with that? And would that be the kind of thing that you would go into in therapy?
Yes, I mean, anybody that comes into therapy, of course there's validation at the start. You know, we of course we need to look at the root causes and the trauma and the original reasons why somebody develops an eating disorder. You know, it's a very complex process. Not everybody develops eating disorders. There is laid down reasons why people do, namely 0 to 7 things, potentially not. There might be other traumas, et cetera, et cetera. We do need to ascertain why. But what I'm saying is we don't need to fixate on that. We don't need to stay on that point and spend week in, week out discussing the past, re-traumatizing, revisiting. You know, what I do is I work in the now with clients. So, yes, we acknowledge, we validate this is why you have what you have. And then I work with the client to focus on the fact that they are not an eating disorder. They are not anorexia or bulimia or binge purge or whatever, that they have this disorder. It's a mental health condition that becomes an addiction. So it's kind of like, yes, we acknowledge it, we validate it, then we separate from the self. But what I like to do is keep it in the now and work very fluidly with what is actually happening right now, rather than keeping on going backwards. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah.
In a lot of traditional therapy, a lot of time can be spent on rediscussing the past and revisiting the reasons why, et cetera, which isn't necessarily going to destructure the behaviours and the problems that are happening right now. Because food, feelings, disorder, you know, mental health is fluid. Things change as time goes by. You know, the reasons that somebody first becomes disordered with their eating are not going to be the same 5, 10, or 5 months, days, you know, whatever down the line. It's a fluid process and it changes, which is why, as much as I do acknowledge the whys, I tend to work in destructuring in the now and with what is actually happening right now. So the coping skills, et cetera, come in further along the line, once we've kind of ascertained what's going on day to day. How is this manifesting? How is it showing up for you? How are you enabling? There's a lot of elements that go into it, you know, and coping skills do come into it, but a little bit further down the line, yeah.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I really like that approach of sort of not, you know, like rehashing, re-traumatizing. I think it's, for me, I don't have traumas. I don't have one like big reason that kicks all this off. I just
might just be a thing. You might have just decided I just want to go on a diet. I just don't, you know, it isn't always a massive trauma. It's like I said, it's so individual. It might have just been a thing like I don't like the way I look.
Completely. I completely agree. I was really interested because you get to a sort of place of like comfort with your eating disorder, almost like you feel like you can almost trick yourself that, oh, I'm not sick enough, or oh, there's nothing wrong and stuff like that. I wonder, did you ever experience that, and did you, like, how did you overcome it if you did experience that?
So what happens generally, and what happened with me and what I find with my clients, is it becomes a very safe space normality to live in. Like you said yourself, the reasons for people developing eating disorders are very different. For me, I was very, very young and I started binge eating, and I developed a relationship with food where I'd learned that I could stuff down my feelings. I could deal with physical pain. I could deal with emotions. I could deal with external things that were happening to me that I couldn't necessarily process and cope. I could numb and stuff down with food and feelings. And that's how it kind of developed, and that's how it went from there. I don't know how it was for you.
Yeah, I suppose it's, for me, it was more of like a denial, as in that I thought I don't have a problem. And then like I would
Right, so it becomes your daily reality because you kind of learn that way of living. It's like, I don't want to feel these feelings, and this is how I cope. And obviously, it develops into an addiction because your brain chemistry changes. You change physiologically, whatever kind of eating disorder you have. And I don't know about you, but I personally developed this kind of mind chatter and this constant voice that was with me at all times. And that became my life, that became my reality. And I kind of isolated myself in that life. And for the first 10 years, I didn't really want to recover. You know, that was where I was. I was in complete control of my body. I was in control of my feelings. I didn't have to feel if I didn't want to. I could control my weight and shape. So in a way, yeah, you are kind of sort of pretending that you're not ill, if you like, when really you are actually quite ill. Or, you know, it becomes your identity and it becomes your safe space reality, I think. I think that's a common theme for a lot of sufferers.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, completely. We've spoken about how there's a lot of shame and people don't really want to talk about like purging behaviors and stuff because it can be quite like startling to people, especially when they don't have a clue about eating disorders. And I would want to ask your opinion and just like your thoughts on what would you want people to know? Like this goes for people like general public, no idea about eating disorders, as well as maybe because I people's parents listen to this podcast, so I wonder, speaking to people's parents of like sufferers with purging kind of behaviors and stuff that has a bit more stigma around it, what would you say to those people?
You know, I would say to them, and as I did to myself, that eating disorders are mental health conditions and they become addictions. They are not inherent parts of you as a person. They are not flaws. They are not, you know, you're not broken genetically. It is a way of coping. And when somebody binges and purges, whatever the reason behind that may be, they change their physiologically they change, but they also change their brain chemistry. The neurotransmitters in their brain become triggered in different ways. They release endorphins in relation to starvation. When somebody binges and purges, they release dopamine, the reward systems light up. So it becomes like any other addiction, really. And it's kind of separating the person from the disorder and actually saying that yes, you know, they're not it. They have a mental health condition and it is an addiction. It's an addiction to the behaviors behind the disorder, whatever they might be. Does that
Yeah.
make sense? Kind of explaining it like that somebody is suffering from a mental health issue, which is also an addiction.
Yeah, no, that completely makes sense. And I think that's the most, and I was able to like truly believe that all of these things, because I personally struggled a lot with like laxative abuse, as well as exercise, and I suppose they're both forms of purging. But when I was dealing with especially the laxative abuse, I was very like ashamed of it because it was something you just absolutely didn't want to speak about. But I think once I was actually able to realize literally every single thing is just a symptom of the disorder. So like when I was starving myself, that was just a symptom. When I was weighing myself obsessively, that was just a symptom, same as the laxatives. It's all just kind of like they're all equally damaging in certain ways, and it's all just there's stuff you can work on, but it's definitely, yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying. It's really
It's not
helpful.
an inherent broken, flawed part of you. You are suffering from an eating disorder, you know, and those symptoms are part of that disorder. It's like you wouldn't say, I am a chest infection. Therefore, I spit mucus wherever I go. You know, I know that's a little bit vague, but it's kind of like the same analogy. You know, you're not that. You are suffering from that. And you know, laxative abuse, there's huge shame around it. It's because of the nature of the behavior, and it's the same as eating massive amounts of food and being sick, any kind of purging, apart from exercise bulimia, which I feel is the only acceptable real, you know, I think if you go onto any social media platform, unfortunately, there's almost promotion of it in a way. I see a lot of very poorly people who are very, very, very ill. But that's fine. That's an accepted way of purging, if you like,
Yeah.
because it's very easy to hide and to see it in a negative light. Whereas laxatives, obviously, making yourself sick, it's embarrassing and it's not what you want people to know about, is it?
I completely agree. I'm really like actually really happy you brought that up because it just reminded me of there's been a lot of conversations I've been having with people who Just to preface this, I don't particularly like Instagram social media for eating disorder recovery. I just feel like it's very like slippery slope and stuff. But at the same time, I know that a lot of people find it very helpful, and there's a lot of people on it and a lot of people sharing their like recovery journey and stuff. But there is a lot of people who are very much almost moved from one set of symptoms to another, which includes exercise, and then they post about their exercise. But the point is that all these people messaging me on Instagram saying, oh, like this so and so's done this, like this is so disordered, this is so triggering, and I can completely like understand where they're coming from. And I just wonder what your thoughts on, especially on social media, but as you just said, like it's so socially acceptable, if you know what I mean. I just wonder what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, let me pick one part of that out if that's okay. So the triggering part is very, very, very controversial within eating disorders. It's, to somebody who's got disordered eating, I think you could be pretty much triggered by anything because food is everywhere, okay? Body shapes and sizes are everywhere, certain types of clothes are everywhere, makeup is everywhere. Filters are everywhere. Obviously, you get where I'm going with this. Exercise is everywhere. And I think a lot of time is wasted on social media in particular nowadays in what's triggering and what isn't triggering. And, because to one person, exercise can be triggering, and to another person, it can be recovery. Like I've had a few clients that have actually never exercised and have found that exercise or moving their body or becoming fluid or in touch with their body is actually a great way of recovering, whereas to somebody else it's completely and utterly triggering. So when you say the word triggering, I have a little bit of a bugbear with that because you can't help but be triggered. There's going to be a picture of the booze on a outside the supermarket. You can't then say, take that down, that's triggering. It's kind of, it's a tough one. Yeah, it is a tough one. But with exercise bulimia, it's very, very difficult for people to realize when somebody has a problem. That's a whole another podcast. Those are my most difficult clients because what they do is, like you say, it can be seen as very positive, very socially acceptable. They can look absolutely amazing, but still be absolutely consumed and self-harming because not always, but eating disorders are often very much about self-harming. Mine most certainly was. It morphed from, I pretty much went for every diagnostic criteria, but at the end, it was most definitely about self-harming. And I definitely think that exercise bulimia is part of that umbrella. But it's very difficult to realise, to recognise. It's very easy to hide. It's congratulating.
It really is. Yeah, it completely is. I mean, it's also something that, like, you can't, like, a doctor in good faith probably won't tell you to cut out exercise because it is, in general, seen as like a really healthy part. I mean, obviously, that depends on extremes, but for me personally, like, when I've struggled with, because I just side note, but I'm diagnosed with OCD and exercise plays a role in that. So when I've gone through periods of really struggling with it, I've had doctors say to me like, oh, just reduce it, just like do this, that and the other, and I'm like I wish I could, but it's almost like it's a part of something else. But yeah, you're completely right, it's a whole nother topic. And I just want to say I totally agree with what you were saying about triggers and being like you can't remove them from the world, like you're going, it's a reflection of what state you're in. Because I used to be triggered by like literally every single thing would be triggering, but obviously you move as you go through the process, you stop being triggered by certain things. So
Exactly. But I would like to, with OCD, that is a whole different disorder. And when you involve exercise with obsessive compulsive disorder, that is a very difficult and different situation than an eating disorder, most definitely. So what with me, I don't agree in any sort of recovery with extremes as such, because that's kind of like the basis of what disordered eating is about. That black and white thinking, that perfectionism, the yes and no, don't do this, do that, et cetera. But when it comes to OCD, that's very different. And in that incidence, potentially, it might be better to move away from the exercise. But that is a different avenue.
Yeah, completely. So the other point you mentioned in your email was really interesting about men suffering with eating disorders and how it's sort of, there's more stigma, and it's sort of, I guess, in my opinion, it gets quite overlooked. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on men suffering with eating disorders.
Men and eating disorders. Yeah, I mean, it's very, very difficult. I do have, I think about probably about a third to a quarter of my clients are male, and it's extremely difficult for men because we just talked about the shame attached to admitting that you have binge-purge behaviors, etc., you know, as a woman and or as anybody. But eating disorders are predominantly seen by society as female illnesses, unfortunately, by people who've either not suffered for them or don't understand them clinically or personally. They're kind of seen as she wanted to lose weight, she didn't like the way she looked, she wasn't happy with her face. And when you take that from a male perspective, it's, and these are not my words, these are kind of client words that are coming to mind, it's very demasculinizing, it's very anti-man, you know, it kind of goes against everything that they are supposed to be as a man, which kind of adds that extra layer of shame. You know, I very often have had to work through the shame getting to the fact that they actually have an eating disorder before we even start to move into the recovery program, into the transitional or the core transitional program, because it's so difficult for men to even be understood and accepted as having eating disorders because they're seen as feminine, not by me, of course, but by society in general. They're seen as female or feminine type conditions, which needs to change. And recently, with there has been, I think Ed Sheeran recently put something out about him having a binge condition, and there's definitely been some traction going on with men speaking out a little bit more, which is really positive. Because I think, you know, I'm not a great lover of statistics, but they do say 1 in 4 eating disorders suffers as a man, but I reckon it's half and half personally, especially when you get into binge eating disorder. I don't think it's a you know, and when we're saying man, it many people identify as many different things anyway, right? So it kind of, it's seen as a woman's disorder. So whatever you identify as, if you don't identify as a traditional cis woman, then you know, it's more difficult for you, isn't it? You are in a subgroup, and that brings extra shame, I really do think. I think that it should be opened up and accepted that an eating disorder is an eating disorder. We don't subtype depression, do we?
No.
A section of society, you know, but with it, not you and I, but in general, eating disorders are kind of assigned to women, aren't they?
Yeah, no, that's really true. And
It is true. It's unfortunate, yeah.
and there's so many like just stereotypes in general with eating disorders, and I think it's so unfortunate that a lot of them aren't just confined to like media, but it's literal like doctors and stuff, they make assumptions. And I think it's, I wondered actually your opinion on, because there's so much overlap between these like diagnostic boxes, and people can suffer with different ones at different stages of their life and like all together and they morph it. I just wondered like what are your thoughts on how people separate?
I cannot stand diagnostic criteria for eating disorders. You know, they base it on appearance or weight or behaviors. Like, you know, I most definitely have clients who have anorexia or anorexic traits who would be considered overweight by a GP. Therefore, they wouldn't be accessible for any kind of treatment or help or support at all. You know, you can get bulimic clients that are extremely underweight who would instantly be classed as anorexic. So my views are, I do not like diagnostic criteria. And eating disorders are so very fluid. Food is always there, you know, emotions, feelings, food, we change all the time. And fitting people into boxes based on a 0.5 of a BMI is, it's not a good way to go. And it does deny a lot of people access to treatment. Eating disorders do not have a size, they do not have a shape, and they do not have a set of criteria as far as I'm concerned. And I only use the diagnostic words because I have to, otherwise nobody would know what we're talking about. It's kind of like I have to. Do you understand what I mean? In practice, I tend not to use the names, but if I didn't and just said disordered eating, I would be speaking to nobody, unfortunately. But that's what it is. It's that all of it is disordered eating, whatever weight, shape, size you are, right? It's all disordered eating.
Yeah, I think it'll be so reassuring and like it will help people to hear that, because especially people who maybe they haven't like been diagnosed with anything, or maybe they have, but they're just like feeling not quite right. But I think from hearing that from a professional therapist, I think it will help people. And I also wonder, I feel like everyone listening kind of wants to know like how you recover? Like, what is there a magic pill, or is it like what are some of your practical, like tangible points that you would say to someone, either like starting recovery or just like someone kind of questioning, like, oh my God, I've got a problem. What do I do? How do I help myself?
So with me, I had to reach a crisis point to even start to access recovery, and that does very often happen. If I was speaking to somebody directly, which I often am, or to people who love somebody with an eating disorder, I have a very inbuilt understanding that that first point of communication is going to be with that mind chatter that the person suffers with. They know that they want to be well. But, and this is assumption, it's not with everybody, but at the same time, that eating disordered voice is fighting back the whole time. You're probably familiar with that. So as much as you're wanting to get well, there's that part of you that's like, no, run, 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 get the hell out of here. They know exactly what they know what's happening. They're gonna stop us, we need to go. So it's kind of like the first port of call is realizing that you are dealing with that. You are separate from your eating disorder, and that part of you that's telling you don't want to recover, it's kind of like coming to terms with that, negotiating with that, and realizing that that is your first port of call. But my main approach is, like I said earlier, is looking at how the disorder is in the now, not constantly looking at the past or the reasons. Like you didn't even said you didn't even have a reason, So it's about looking at what is happening now. Why? What is this doing for you? How is it serving you? How are you maintaining it? What does your daytime structure look like? That's the kind of approach that I have, and that's what I say to people. What is this giving you in the now, right now? Not yesterday or last week or when it first started, et cetera, et cetera. How does this show up for you each day? And when it does show up, what is it doing for you? Is it numbing feelings? Is it taking something away? It's kind of like building a pattern of what is going on and having a real strong look at it. Is there enabling? Is there somebody enabling these structures? Are you living your life in a certain way that so that you're enabling your eating disorder? We kind of build up a really crystal clear picture of what's going on. And that's the first point of recovery. Not talking about what happened back then or what weight you are or what behaviors you have, et cetera, et cetera. Quick synopsis of that is great. All right, I do X, Y, and Z. But the main crux of it is what's happening in the now. What is it giving you and why? And that's what we do. And then we start to destructure. We start to look at how we can solve the problems right now.
That's great. That sounds very similar to, I think what really helped me was like, yeah, like almost literally like writing down step by step, why do I feel so attached to this? Maybe it's like being underweight or certain behaviors, and it was like then I literally just replaced it with, well, tried to anyway as best you can, but.
You've got a lot of work to do. You've got to rewire pathways in your brain. You've got to look at every single aspect of what's going on, change it up, address it. But it's basically finding out for the individual what is there for them right now. What's happening? What is it? How is this serving you now?
I really like that your focus is so much on like just that present moment practical steps rather than so much looking into the past. I think that's, well, for me at least, that's been the most helpful when people have done that with me. But yeah, I mean, it's just inspiring and motivating to speak to someone who has recovered and just, especially after so long suffering. And I just think it's really, really great that you are sharing about the types of behaviors that don't really get a lot of like airtime, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I have no shame. I'm completely recovered now, and it's a very bold statement to make. But there was a time in my life where I would literally spend 6 hours a day binging and purging, and I've had to sort of look at that in myself and separate myself from it and say that was me when I had that mental health condition and that addiction. And I don't have any shame in it now. Absolutely not, because that wasn't me. That was me when I was ill. And now I'm recovered, and I find that having those discussions, and very often when I have clients that come in for therapy, it's so very helpful really that because I've been able to, I don't obviously do that, it's not professional boundaries to do that in the room kind of thing, but once they've heard my story, they kind of like have that understanding that I understand, that empathetic background there.
That is so important. I wish that, obviously, I don't wish more therapists had eating disorders, but there's a complete difference speaking to someone with personal experience and without.
You cannot learn in a book.
No.
I understand what you've been through just by your words and, you know, by the things that you're saying, even with the OCD, obviously, because I've had elements of OCD myself and I've worked with OCD clients, but it's that understanding. But yeah, professional training helps as well. You know, it definitely is a really good combination. The lived experience and the professional experience works really well in synergy to be able to help people and understand people on that deeper level. That's what I constantly searched for myself when I was trying to recover. And unfortunately, I didn't find it. I had to find it within myself.
Absolutely. I mean, it honestly is like, I just think it's going to be so motivating for people, especially because my podcast demographics, it does sort of lean more towards people 40, 50, even 60 years old. And a lot of them have reached out personally and said they've struggled for like 20 plus years. And I think that on the Instagram, and I'm not on TikTok, but the TikTok, I don't know, maybe YouTube as well, it's all very much like 15 to 25 year olds. And I feel like it's a massive gap for people who've struggled for a long time.
And that's their identity is so embedded within their eating disorder that it becomes extremely difficult to change. But the program that I have is it works so quickly because we work in the now. I've had people with 25 years worth of illness make massive changes within 6 weeks because it's about destructuring, it's about rewiring, it's about walking different pathways, it's about looking at the way things are and kind of taking it down brick by brick, you know? How can we destructure this proactively, individually, in the most safest, comfortable way for you on the level without, it's almost like we don't need to, oh, this is because, and we just look at it as it is and pick it apart, ball of wool, you know, just unraveling.
Completely. I feel like there's just so much to say. There's so many topics to cover and it would be really interesting to talk more about exercise, but I don't want to keep you too long. But I do want to ask what personally, if you don't mind sharing, what did you find the most difficult in your like recovery process and how did you manage to get through it?
I mean, like I said, for me, I had 25 years of eating disorder, started with binge eating when I was very young and then anorexia when I was 19, which then descended into severe, what they called binge purge anorexia. So I would not eat all day and then I would binge and make myself sick all night. And I wasn't able to recover using traditional methods at all. I got to a crisis point in my life where I had to make a life and death decision. Which was very, very difficult, very unpleasant. And it was a place that I got forced to. So I had to then make a decision and I was on my own. And it was extremely difficult. And the most difficult part, I think, was sitting through the initial urges to binge and purge. It was literally like sitting on a timer. I had to kind of wait out these urges. So it would be like 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, then 15 minutes until these urges subsided, which they do. And because I'd used my eating disorder for so many years of my life to numb my feelings, my emotions, my reactions, my responses, as I learned to sit with these urges, I had to then experience the feelings and emotions underneath my eating disorder. So it was kind of like a double whammy. So I had to time out those urges, which were extremely difficult. It was not easy. I had to find ways of distracting myself, ways of getting through those first 5 minutes, then those 10 minutes, because they do subside. This is the thing, and it does for everybody. You can do it. And I developed my own kind of toolkit ways of coping. You know, what I actually did was put myself into positions that made it impossible for me to binge and purge. I made the most hostile environment I possibly could for myself, which invariably saved my life because I made it so I couldn't do it. I literally made it impossible. And that's what I had to do to get myself over that first part, which was so very hard. I made it impossible. Yeah. I threw myself in there and I made it so that I could not go and stuff massive load of food and throw it up again. So I made it impossible. I took apart the innate systems that I had around me. So I'd been using my husband to kind of enable me by making him emotionally blackmailing him. You know, you have to buy food to find out. You have to look after the kids, or you have to do it in bed. So very frank to touch him. I was like, "What? It's not me. I've got an illness. Would I me walk away?" I think I screamed it at him. Please just don't. And he's like, "Okay, you know." So the most difficult part was getting through those initial urges and those initial thoughts and feelings that were the mind chatter of my eating disordered voice. And at the start, it kicked back so strong. It was like battling with myself. It felt like it split into two. It was like part of me was my eating disorder, and one part of me. One part of me wanted to be well, one part of me didn't care and just wanted to die. So it was like this internal battle. And I knew that I was at the point of mental and physical, physically I would not have been able to carry on. So I did kind of have no choice. I could have, well, obviously I didn't have a choice, but that was the most difficult part. So I had to separate myself from that part of me and then deal with that part of me the best way I could. And it was extremely hard. And people often say to me about gaining weight, was it hard to gain weight? To be honest, not as hard as it was to feel food in my stomach. And that will ring a lot of bells and make a lot of sense to a lot of people. I was body dysmorphic. I was ritualistically obsessed with my binge purge regime. I was very counting. I had to be sick a certain amount of times as an OCD sufferer. I'm sure you will, you know, understand that. Like, I would have to be 6,000 times. I have to do this. I have to do that. You know, detaching from those things.
And was there a sort of cut-off point, and then you were just like, you had the urges, but you just didn't engage with the behaviors? Or was it was were there times you had like slip-ups, and if so, like how did you not let that put you back?
Most definitely, yeah, I had relapses, most definitely. And there were times where I lost weight as well. When I didn't binge and purge, and I just would start to lose weight, and I would think, hang on a minute, you know, is it slipping back? I'm slipping back in. Of course, you know, nobody's going to have a straight path to recovery. But as I say to people now in therapy or in recovery, it doesn't mean that you need to reset. You didn't just fail the whole thing. You know, everybody slips up in every single thing that we do. Every change that we try and make in our brain means that we have to rewire a pathway. We have to walk down a different pavement. We have to take a different journey. And doing that is not always straightforward. There are some days where you're going to want to walk down a different path, but you're going to turn around and go back down the old one, right? So it was just being able to forgive myself and say, okay, I've done that. It doesn't mean I have to go back to square one. I'll just start again, you know? And you get stronger as time goes by. And some people say to me, you know, how can you say that you're fully recovered? And I can now say that I am fully recovered, but it was most definitely a process. And like you say, it did taper as time went on.
No, that's probably really reassuring. It is to me personally. I've had people be very much black and white with behaviors, and it's like, if you do this, then you're not in recovery anymore. And it's like, you can't really be expected to just completely switch and then not engage with anything that you spent years doing. So,
Of
yeah.
course, any habit change involves literally changing the neural pathways in your brain, which takes a certain amount of time, you know. And if you slip up or relapse, et cetera, once, then you just go back and you keep trying and you keep going. And you know, it's nearly 10 years for me now, but most definitely 2, 3 years in, I would have found myself not eating in the day, and I thought, that's not where I want to go. This is starting to go somewhere that I don't want to know. So it's that realization and then reining it back, not being too tough on myself, reminding myself, well, actually, look how far I've come. And going from there. You don't reset because you relapse.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you reset. That doesn't mean you've failed the whole assignment. You know, you just get back up and you keep going. It's a tough thing to do. You know, eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of all mental health issues, and they are the most difficult things to treat. They are very, very difficult. Out of all of the clients I've worked with, eating disorders, I really did choose the most difficult job because it is a tough path to recovery, but it's achievable. And the pros far outweigh the cons when you actually do get yourself into strong recovery. You're going to relapse. Everybody relapses, but those pathways get stronger and those new neural connections form in the brain and eventually they become normality. And that's when you get to the point where you have that strong recovery because your neural pathways have changed so much so that you just walk them same way as you clean your teeth every day. You know, they just become your new way. But getting there, of course, there's going to be splits. There's going to be the synergy is not always going to be there, but it's about loving yourself. Well, not even loving yourself, but just letting yourself, all right, fine, I messed up. Let's just start again.
Yeah. Yes. And it's really like, again, inspiring and motivating to hear you say that you are fully recovered, because so many, and I, by the way, I have not been eating disordered for very long. So for professionals to tell me, I've had them say to me, oh, like, you know, you're just, it's just going to be something you have to live with your whole life. You're never going to really recover from. But it's really interesting just to hear you say that you are fully recovered, because I can completely see how that would be possible given the fact that brains change, they're plastic, aren't they? And it's like,
And to not to cut you off, but to look at the severity, the place that I was, you know, after all of those years in the age of 9 and then developing that bulimia at 19, it took my career, it took years of my life. Like there are literally years of my life that I can't remember. All of the enamel of my teeth went, you know, I could talk for ages about the catastrophic effect it had on my body. But I never thought, and I never ever thought I would get better. I was so ill, you know, literally 6 hours a day I could binge and purge on the regular. But I have recovered fully. Yes, I have had to have extensive dental work in order to get my teeth out of pain and get back to where they were. But my body has fully recovered. I mean, I'm 48 soon, and I did have a de I had more than one DEXA scan, bone scan when I was anorexic, and I was borderline osteoporosis. I did borderline have osteoporosis, and now my bone density is completely normal. You can recover, and if someone can go to the extremes that I went to and be as isolated, I didn't even answer the telephone. Literally, I had no life. I went nowhere. I saw nobody. And now I'm absolutely just the complete opposite. You know, I'm fierce. I'm loud. I know who I am now, and I didn't before. And it's just like there's definitely not a lifelong thing, which is my whole message. You are not broken. You are not flawed. You are not, you know, saddled with this disorder for the rest of your life. That just simply isn't true. It's a mental health condition, it's an addiction, and you can recover. Anybody can. With the right approach and the right intervention and the right knowledge, it can be done.
That is really honestly incredible, and I think it's such a I wish that that point of view was what is told to people. I wish that someone had said that to me. I wish that someone had like said that to pretty much everyone who's gone to get help and sort of been, especially for people like you say who have gotten to such severe places and who have struggled for so long. It's just really sad that the doctors they speak to might not even have that hope for them that they could recover. I mean, as you said, it is possible, but.
It is possible. And that and the fact that you have to be a certain shape and size to have a certain eating disorder. There are so many people out there who would be considered overweight, who are suffering with anorexia. You know, there are so many people out there who have different sets of, you know, symptoms, but because they don't have a certain set of symptoms in a certain order, they're not diagnosable. They're obviously not suffering enough. They're not accessible to gain treatment, which absolutely makes me mad because everybody should be recognized as unique. You know, we don't fit into diagnostic boxes. It's not how it works, is it? But unfortunately, that's very much the mainstay and the mainstream of eating disorders treatment now.
Yeah, it's completely ridiculous because it's like looking, it's a mental health condition. You wouldn't look at someone with schizophrenia and just be like, well, you're not underweight, so you're
I
fine, you
can't
don't need help.
see it. I think you're fine. Jog on.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. Most definitely not. Yeah, it's not something that you can see. Eating disorders again, they don't have a shape, they don't have a size. Most definitely not.
Out of curiosity, and this is kind of echoing a lot of the questions I got from a lot of people asking, basically most of my listeners do have anorexia, and most of the people who follow, who engage and ask questions, they have anorexia, mainly restrictive symptoms and stuff. And a lot of them are asking about how, and I'm curious as well, like, how do you differentiate when you are recovering and you're having to sit with those urges to like binge and purge and stuff? How do you differentiate between that and a kind of return of like the natural body hunger cues? And what do you do in that situation? Like, is it hunger? Do I eat this? Or is it something that I need to like work through? And is this a part of the disorder? I'm just wondering, what's your opinion? What's your take on that?
You need to kind of lay down an agreement with yourself on a certain level. So even if that means that you have to discuss with your eating disordered voice, if you like, or that part of you, there needs to be a basic kind of calorific, if you like, or nutritional intake in order so that the scales don't tip. You know, there needs to be a basic agreement there. And what in traditional recovery, they will say you have to have three meals and two snacks, et cetera, et cetera. You have to have nutrition, you have to eat this, you have to eat that. That's not real and it's not achievable. But at the same time, I think that's kind of what you were saying, is how do you know, you have to eat a certain amount in order to be in recovery, but what you eat and how you eat it is very individual, and that can look different for so many people. So it's about finding those first steps, those first baby steps. What can I eat and how can I eat it? And that's okay, you know, it doesn't have to fit. You know, like, do I need a meal plan? There isn't an anorexic out there, okay, and then maybe there is, everybody's individual, who's going to say, I'm going to say, here's your meal plan, this is your breakfast, this is your, I don't have a meal plan, I eat intuitively, I eat what I want when I want to, when my body tells me to, I have a meal plan. You know, that's unachievable, it's unrealistic. And when I work with clients, it's more about what can you achieve at this point. And if those are the baby step points, then we have to look at what we have to have a discussion pretty much with that eating sort of part of ourselves. We need to do something here so that we can balance the scale, so that we can start to move into recovery, so we can start to do these core transitions. But it needs to be something that's sustainable for you as an individual. And I've had clients, and there will be doctors out there whose heads will spin around, but they've had to eat small pieces of chocolate every 2 hours because that's the only thing that they can maintain with milky coffees or whatever that may be. But those are their baby steps into stopping the balance from tipping. Those are that's their way of, you know, as long as it's not massively calorifically deficient, then we're still maintaining the disorder. Does that make sense? It's about finding some kind of balance, some kind of gray area, some kind of agreement, and then working towards that. Because personally, really having food in my stomach at the start was absolutely intolerable. I could not bear it. And anybody out there with anorexia will absolutely resonate with what I'm saying. It was unbearable. I would rather have some pins stuck in me at that point. Yeah, but what I had to do was very, very slowly, baby steps, take a little bit, sit with it. One mouthful, sit with it, feel it, get through it, a little bit more. Does that make sense without me going through every single stage? And it sounds like I'm being patronizing, but I'm not, because anyone who's been there will know that that's how it looks and that's how it feels. You're not going to say, you're not going to wake up one morning as an anorexic and go, right, got my meal plan, I'm just going to jog on and eat my breakfast. It's not going to happen, you know? You need to have that negotiation discussion with yourself. And that's what I did. And I actually used to talk to myself. I got diagnosed with psychosis, which I've been saying a lot lately, which I find absolutely hilarious, because what I was actually doing was separating Scarlett from the binge purge anorexic. So I'm like, right, you, how am I going to deal with this today? I'm going to eat that. And with me, it was milky drinks to start with. Literally, milky drinks. And a lot of medical professionals say, oh, well, you can't do that. Well, that's exactly how I stayed alive to start with. And I built up from there. So I learned to tolerate that in my stomach. And I timed myself out, and I sat with the feelings and I sat with the emotions. And I was like, oh, that's a new feeling. Hang on. Let's just feel it. Don't react, feel it. And I made it impossible. Does that make sense? I put myself into situations, even if I had to go out in public, where I would do that. And then I would be like, yes, I've done those 5 minutes. I've done the 10 minutes. I've done the, okay, yeah, of course. And I have a bit more. And does that make sense? I could talk for hours. That's how you grow, and that's how you go. And it is baby steps to start with. But meal plans, writing everything down, please no. That's maintaining an eating disorder. That's an eating disorder. If you're like, I don't care how people don't write, I'm gonna eat this and this and this, that's absolutely insane, you know?
So for somebody perhaps having to weight restore, so they have to, hit a certain number of food every day, well, roughly, and they have been given a meal plan. So that was me. I had to follow a certain thing, and I agree. It was it, in many ways, it does sort of uphold the disorder because you're so focused on hitting that exact thing. But at the same time, I wonder how do you transition almost off of it? I just wonder, like, how would you kind of get off the meal plan without that worsening the binge purge part?
I totally get what you're saying. So when you maintain that balance, this is what I find with people. So when you get that calorific balance, if you like, I hate the word calorie. Like I said earlier, everything is triggering. Whatever I say is going to trigger somebody. But when you get that nutritional balance, whatever that might look like, and with my clients, it's not traditionally what a doctor would suggest. But when you get to that point where your body is not tipping into starvation and it's not tipping into overeating. Does that make sense? Like we're maintaining a kind of balance. You're not hungry and you're not overfed. You don't feel like you've overeaten, but at the same time, you're not starving. That's when you start to recognize when you're hungry or when you're having an emotion or a feeling, because anorexia is something that I experienced for a very long time. Obviously I've studied it, but I've experienced it for a very long time, and I had to learn what was hunger and what was emotion and what was feeling. And I could only do that when I was able to get, and it really was a basic sustenance for my body. And because I was a low body weight, that wasn't a huge amount of food to start off with. It was medically enough to stop the balance tipping. And then I was able to kind of feel into myself as to what I was feeling. Does that make sense? Because I wasn't overfed and I wasn't underfed, so I could say, what is that feeling? What do I feel? And as I started to recover with the baby steps that I described, I went through the most huge range of emotions, and not all of them are horrible. Anger, rage, joy, laughter. It was like my body was springing back from years of being numbed. And I mean, I was saying on a podcast earlier, when I was anorexic, I didn't get spots. I didn't catch colds. I never even got ill.
That's weird, isn't
How does the body do that? It's absolutely fascinating. There's no medical answer because I've searched for it, because I'm like that. But it's kind of like your body just shuts down. But when you get that kind of base level of nutrition there, then you kind of that's when your body kind of wakes up and becomes alive, if you like. And that's when you kind of deal with the feelings of hunger or feeling, and do I want to self-harm? Some people do it. For me, it was self-harm. That's what my eating disorder was about. It isn't for everybody, but it was like, what am I feeling in the now, and what am I doing with it? Have I eaten my? Yes, I have. So I'm not hungry. So what is it that I'm feeling? I want to self-harm. I want to binge. I want to purge. Why? Actually, because I'm annoyed about X, Y. Do you see what I mean? Learning process, it's a slow process, but I will say again and again to somebody with anorexia, it is a very, very slow process at the start, because even the feeling of food in your body is so very difficult, and I understand that.
Yeah, no, I think that's all very clear. I think that will help people. And it is just really interesting comparing the things you're saying to things I've heard from other professionals and doctors, and I just think it doesn't honestly make such a difference having personal experience and speaking to someone rather than not. But yeah, no, I'm sure that's all been really helpful. I do have a question from a listener. I just picked a random one, but I think it will be interesting. Basically, they said, "What can I do for my family? My eating disorder is harder for them than me."
First of all, it's not their responsibility to do something for your family. That's such a trait of somebody who, who's got a disorder, to be worrying about everybody else. It's potentially telling your family that, I am suffering from this mental health condition, and I am I am in the grips of an addiction, and there is a part of me that speaks for me. And sometimes it is difficult for me to overcome that part of me, but I'm trying. And because my behavior is the way it is, it doesn't mean that it has anything to do with you. Yeah, I'm fighting my own battle. I have this voice, I have this part of me that is on a mission to do whatever it's trying to do. But I do have another part of me, which is me, the actual myself, that wants to be well and that loves you and is trying to, I'm trying to do the best for myself. But I don't think that sufferers should be taking on the responsibility of their families. I think that's the families should be looking into that themselves and doing that job themselves. Because when you've got anorexia, that's enough in itself. I want to say to that family, you know, that person is suffering enough. Can you do some research and
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It does make a difference how your family acts, and I think support in general is a bit disheartening when people say, "Oh, you need support, you need these people around you," because I guess some people don't necessarily have it and they still manage to recover on their own in many ways, but
it
no.
doesn't really make a lot of difference. I know this sounds terrible, but some families are like, you gotta eat. Why are you doing this to us? You know, why are you so this? Why are you so that? And then you'll have another family like, I love you so much. Please let me help you. Let me feed you. I'm suffering watching you. This is breaking my heart. Both of those approaches are extremely difficult for somebody in the grips of an eating disorder because they're already dealing with their own pain. You know, and it's kind of like it is a difficult situation because the family needs to take responsibility for their own feelings and do their research because the person is fighting their battles, aren't they? You know, and they will get different approaches from different people, but ultimately their family has to understand that they have a mental health condition and they have an addiction. It's not them, it's just how they are at that time and that they're doing their best to.
Yeah, I think that is kind of the overarching theme is like the symptoms and the things you're struggling with. It's not you, it's the disorder.
And play to a family, you know, that when you're talking to somebody with an eating disorder, the first thing that is going to come up in that person's response is that eating disordered self. Is that voice is going to come straight back at you. I love you, please eat. No, it's not that the person doesn't love the mum, the dad, the cousin, the brother, the aunt. It's not that they don't love them. It's that they're dealing with their mental health condition that has its own set of rules and regulations, and at that point, the kickback is so strong. Does that make sense? That's who they're conversing with. They're conversing with the disordered self at the start, and that's what people need to understand. And very often, just saying, "I love you, I'm here for you, and if I can help, then I think that's the best thing you can possibly do." Trying to coerce somebody to eating, or does that make sense? Any approach is going to be too much for someone with an eating disorder because they're going to withdraw, and that disorder part is going to kick back and fight back, and that's just an extra stress on the sufferer.
Yeah, and I think what you said about getting the basic nutrition into your body so your brain actually has the energy to function and your, but I think when that kicks in, then your relations with your family, or at least for me personally, it just got so, it got a lot easier and a lot less friction just because my brain wasn't non-functioning. Do you know what I mean? Like I was able to have more, reasonable conversations and to sort of understand that most of the time my family were on my side. But obviously, when you're so malnourished in the brain, you don't have your own side. You're literally all eaten, sort of, really, at that point. But yeah.
And again, I would say to your listeners that have anorexia, I completely and utterly understand how difficult it is to have food inside your body. But if you work with those baby steps and you take that approach and go super slow and time it out, you can get there. And I say that in a non-patronizing way because that's what I have to do.
No, it's incredibly reassuring because hearing that from someone who has literally done it is completely different to just theoretically hearing it. And I think that's so important in the fact that you're saying that these urges and the feeling of fullness, like, and these urges to binge and urges to purge and stuff, all of them do go away. You just have to get to the other side.
They do. Over a period of minutes, they go slowly, 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 but they do. Yeah. With everybody, yeah.
There was definitely times when I was like, yeah, this is just not going, this is not going to work because you don't know unless you've done it. But I think, yeah, speaking to people and hearing from people who have actually done it obviously makes the world of difference. And I just want to say I'm really grateful that you have agreed to come on. I think it's been really, really valuable hearing from your experience as a professional and also as someone who suffered. I think having the two together is just, is something you can't really.
Well, if you ever want me to jump on a live with your Instagram people, I don't know if Instagram are really up for mentioning, so as a matter of certain code on Instagram. But I'm more than happy to do Q&A. Absolutely no worries.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, cool. It's been great having you. Is there anything you want to say to people? Anything you want them to know? Just
I pretty much said it. There is no shape and size associated with eating disorders. You can be any weight and size and be anorexic. You know, the diagnostic criteria is very cool. There is hope for everybody. You know, everything is triggering. Try not to focus too much on what's triggering and what isn't. Everything is triggering. But there is hope for everyone, because if I can do it, then I wasn't a therapist when I did it either. You know, I was just a person who got to the brink of dying, and I did it. So it can be done.
So that's it. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Massive thank you to Scarlett for joining me today. I hope you guys found it useful. I personally found it very inspiring, very motivational to just hear her speak about her experience. And I think it's always, valuable to hear from a professional. I hope everyone has a great week. I hope you are doing well. And until next time.